Yarn.
Yarn 27. Escape from Madrid.
I was not a member of any political party, but we felt there was no way out. Peace was not possible. At that time, we couldn't stand each other. Divisions and tensions had reached such a point that even seeing a socialist, not to mention a communist, was the same as seeing the devil.
All wars are civil wars because all men are brothers. A guy called Francis Fellignon said that back in the 1600s, and I don't disagree. What makes civil wars different is that when they're over, combatants don't leave the battlefield and go home thousands of miles away from each other. No, they have to live right next to each other, and they have to just get on with life again the best they can. So what tends to happen is that people just don't talk about it. So the next generation doesn't talk about it, and it becomes a sleeping dog no one wants to wake up. Very bad things happen in any war. In civil war, add into the mix old grudges, sectarianism, and social inequalities, and things can escalate to places no one could have ever thought they were capable of. So what happens when someone of a curious nature starts asking questions?
Well, I'm not shy, I have to say.
What happens when someone decides to poke the sleeping dog?
So basically I was just like knocking all the doors that I could.
This is my friend Pablo.
I'm Pablo de Miguel. I'm a Spanish living in Dublin, Ireland, and my passion is about history, and I've been researching a family episode related to the Spanish Civil War that it's basically leading me to writing a book.
This is the story of how Pablo unraveled a family mystery.
Okay, I just want to know more about this guy.
He originally wanted to know what happened to his great uncle during the Spanish Civil War.
I was really ashamed that I didn't even know his name. It was Uncle Pepe. Is just like a nickname.
But this led him to unearth a major international diplomatic incident that was little known until now.
And it is still really unknown, or at least people really don't want to know about it. Nowadays, the Civil War is a really hot topic. My generation couldn't really study. It was kind of like one of those topics that you don't touch.
But that didn't stop Pablo. When he was a child, if anyone mentioned the Civil War, he wanted to know more.
When I was a kid, my grandmother, not always, but certain times, we were kind of talking about the Civil War, which was, it's really uncommon to get grandparents to talk about the Civil War, because it was really traumatic and they didn't want to really renew or revive those feelings, right? And I got to the story of one of my uncles that got killed in Paracuellos. You know, it's a population in Madrid.
Pablo's great uncle was one of the few thousand people killed in what would become known as the Paracuellos Massacre, a series of mass killings of civilians and soldiers by the Republican side of the Spanish Civil War.
In between November and December of 1936, when the war were in, I would say, the first 6 months.
The final death toll still remains a subject of debate and controversy in Spain.
They were prisoners. They took them out from the prison. Just kids. So that's one of the things that really, like, okay, I just want to know more about this guy.
Before we continue, it might make sense to give you some wider context of the period we'll be talking about. The Spanish Civil War is an incredibly complex subject, details of which are still being unearthed and debated to this day. Spain spent much of the 1920s under the dictatorship of Miguel Primo de Rivera. The economic hardships caused by the Great Depression intensified tensions between the classes in Spain. Labour unrest and strikes were widespread in the early 1930s, and the election of February 16, 1936 brought a leftist government to power. The conservative right didn't go along with this. They feared communism and the secularisation of the country and wanted to restore Catholic control and the monarchy. The army mutinied and attempted a military coup. A bloody civil war ensued throughout the country. The Nationalists, as the rebels were called, received support from fascist Italy and Nazi Germany. Nationalists were mostly Roman Catholic, monarchists, high-ranking members of the military, most landowners, and many businessmen. General Franco eventually emerged as the unified leader of the rebels. On the other side, the Republicans received support from the Soviet Union and Mexico. Republicans were made up of communists, anarchists, and socialists, and were mostly urban workers, agricultural laborers, and many of the educated middle class. In the first weeks and months of the revolt, the rebels, or nationalists, achieved control in some areas, primarily in Spanish Morocco, the Canary Islands, and the Balearic Islands. The Republican government managed to put down uprisings from within the major cities, including Madrid and Barcelona.
The attempt of the rebels taking control of Madrid, and it failed. The army was dissolved because the army was the one who was raising, right, and trying to do the coup. So the government just dissolved the army. And what happened is that they basically armed the population. The first 6 months of the war in Madrid, there were no law and order, right? So the policemen were not in place, they were not in charge, there was no army, so the people got rifles, the pistols, the guns, and everything. So, you know, the anarchists and the communists, when they saw they were now law and order, they kind of start their own revolution inside.
So the rebels didn't initially take control of Madrid, but the official government didn't have much control either.
They were kind of the paramilitary kind of things, right? And then they started to prosecute like people that were not aligned with their ideas, and they killed a lot of people without any trials. So the prosecution was not only for the rich kind of aristocratic layer of the society, it was also like labormen that they didn't go to the strike in October 1934.
This is where old scores and retributions surfaced.
Scenes at Oviedo in the Asturias show the aftermath of the fighting with the rebels in the north of Spain.
The 1934 strike Pablo was talking about 2 years before was a major strike action taken by miners in northern Spain against the then conservative government. The strike and the wider demonstrations eventually developed into a violent uprising against the conservative regime.
Civilian casualties amounted to 100, while 200 civil guards were killed.
You must realize that this wasn't just another strike for things like wages or better working conditions. This was a revolutionary strike, and our aim was to overthrow the government and take power.
This revolt has been regarded by some as the first battle of, or the prelude to, the Spanish Civil War.
So they were even killed because of that, like 2 years later. They were just like cleaning and executing, killing all of these people.
Pablo uncovered that his uncle was a soldier in the army, and he was one of those people killed in the very early stages of the war in Madrid during the lockdown by the Republicans.
He was a captain of engineers in the army. So basically, I started to collect information that was really like, okay, I know the profile of this guy in the army. I got into, basically, I was able to redo his life. So it's really interesting because actually my book is not about him. That's a really good start. So maybe we need to cut. So when I was done about him, then I was going to, my family is from Salamanca, which is in the northwest. That's why my family didn't really participate in the civil war, because they were under the part where the war was not happening, because they got into the nationalist kind of control. I was invited to a dinner where I met one of my mom's relatives. And she was the only person alive that get to know José Solves Soler, Uncle Pepe. I was telling her she was 95 by the time. So she was just like, oh, you did a great job, and Culpepper was like this, like that, so I was kind of getting even more information. She told me, you need to study, you need to learn about your great auntie, which was the wife of the Uncle Pepe. I say, why? And she was just like, no, she was in Madrid, because Uncle Pepe was captured in Madrid. José Solves Soler, Uncle Pepe, was deployed in Salamanca.
Here's where the mystery starts. Pablo knew from reading military records that his great uncle was stationed in Salamanca, where his family lived. But he also knew Uncle Pepe was executed just outside Madrid. That's over 200 kilometers away from Salamanca. Now this woman, who knew Uncle Pepe, was saying that Uncle Pepe's wife was also in Madrid with her husband. Soldiers don't usually take their wives with them on deployments.
Everything was just like really curious, and I was just like really, that I was intrigued by the story why they were in Madrid. After knowing these facts, I connected the dots. This guy, the Uncle Pepe, was, you know, in a balloon, and he got an accident. He broke one of his arms in June 1936. And what happened is that he got a medical appointment in Madrid. I don't know why. But then they traveled together to Madrid the day prior to the civil war started.
This is some very bad luck. The Republican militias had locked down the city and were combing the streets for any nationalist sympathizers. Pablo's relatives were in trouble because his great-uncle was in the army and they were from Salamanca.
Salamanca was in control of the rebels and Madrid was in control of the former Republicans.
Madrid, by its position, is a natural fortress, and each day the people make its defenses more impregnable.
Uncle Pepe's fate was clear. He was caught, taken to a prison camp and executed. But Pablo's great-aunt survived the Civil War. She eventually died an old woman back in Salamanca.
That old lady told me you need to know what happened with her because she was in Madrid. She ended up coming back home to Salamanca through Italy. She went from Madrid to Italy and to Italy to Salamanca, which it's a nonsense kind of trip, right? I said, what happened here?
But no one in Pablo's family knew anything else. He'd encountered a second mystery.
So this is where I started researching the story of my great auntie, Manuela Redondo, and it's unbelievable.
Madrid, the condemned city, condemned to terror, fire and havoc, is still in the front line of battle. And the recent news of the British embassy being moved to Valencia confirms the impression that the capital is doomed to suffer even more severely yet, that women and children are being evacuated, sent away out of the danger zone.
She knew that her husband was killed or disappeared. I don't know if she knew right away that her husband was killed. I guess she didn't know that. So she, and I'm assuming this, she felt insecure in Madrid, and then she knocked the door of the Turkish embassy. She got asylum in the Turkish embassy, but I didn't have that from the conversation that I have with this old lady in Salamanca. And the only things that she shared is that she was in Italy before she got back home. And then by reviewing lists, I saw her. So I could identify her on those lists. And then I got a list, like a really big list of almost like 1,000 people. So what happened with a lot of people, and I mean a lot of people, like almost 12,000 people in Madrid, because they were prosecuted by those militia, like the left militia, by the communists and anarchists mainly. So they knocked the door of the embassies and they said, hey, I'm gonna get killed. Can I get in? It was just like literally get in the embassy and never come out. Because if you are out, you are going to be killed.
So what embassy started taking people in?
The main embassies that take refugees were Chile, Argentina, Norway, France, and then the fifth one was Turkey.
I would have expected the Italian and German embassies to be the ones to take in nationalist refugees, seeing as those countries were pro-nationalist.
No, no. What happened with the Italian embassy and what happened with the German embassy is that they recognize Franco's government. So what happened is that the Republican government assaults the Italian and Germany embassy and get the people that were refugees in them. They weren't safe in those embassies because they lost the immunity of the building, right? In the international law, the embassy and the land that occupies the embassy, it's immune. So it's basically treated as if they were their own land in their whole home country. So when they recognized Franco's government, they lost that. So they got assaulted.
Pablo had found his great-aunt's name on a list with 1,000 other people who took refuge in the Turkish embassy, and he knew she eventually made it home. What he wanted to know next was
how they get into the embassy and how they get out of the embassy.
So first up, how did they get in? Very few were Turkish citizens. What kind of people were they?
In the Turkish case, and on other embassies as well, how you get access to the embassy was like, okay, you know the ambassador or you know any other of the diplomats working on that embassy. So mainly aristocrats and people with wealthy people, right, were the first to get into the embassy for two main reasons, because they have access to the ambassador and the diplomats under the ambassador. And because the second reason, and the most important reason, they were the first ones that were prosecuted by the militia because they got a lot of money, they represented the power, and they would like to take off the power. So those were the first guys that got killed in many situations, so they were the first to ask for asylum.
Madrid's high society were using their connections to gain refuge in any embassy they could. And a particularly rich family did one better. They got an embassy to come to them.
One of the aristocratic families in Madrid owned the buildings. They asked asylum to the Turkish embassy, and basically, at the end, he took control of the whole building.
21 Zurbano Street, located in an affluent part of Madrid, was home to the Countess of Arzentales and her family. It's a beautiful six-story palatial townhouse, built in the 1910s in the Art Nouveau style. It features an ornate cut brown stone facade with decorative urns, cast iron balcony railings, and the top floor is bookended with rounded corner turrets that almost look like bell towers. The building was so big, in fact, that the Countess rented out a couple of floors. One floor was rented to the Turkish embassy, another was rented to the Finnish embassy, and the Irish embassy even rented a small office on one floor. So when the Countess's family sought asylum, all they had to do was ask the Turkish embassy to annex the floors the Countess's family inhabited. This eventually extended diplomatic protection to include the whole building and an attached back building. Although, this didn't include the Irish embassy. When civil war broke out, the Irish shut their office and evacuated all their staff. As the lockdown in Madrid intensified, the word got out. Head to 21 Zurbano. So what started out as a safe haven for the Countess's family and the elites, next, ordinary Madrillos came knocking.
And then everything kind of like pours down, right? So the aristocratic, they got all the relationship with the second layer of the society, right? And I would say liberal workers like lawyers, architects, industrials, that kind of like not Welsh people, but more than a plain worker, right? And what happened is that layer of the society got into the embassy. And the third layer, they know all these second layer, and they got into that. And then, and at the end, you could find all kind of people into the embassy. You got from hairdressers, from land workers, farmers, and military people.
Pablo will probably never know exactly how his great aunt found her way inside, but once she was in, she was stuck there.
The two first stories, they didn't even have the windows open, so they were with curtains because they could get spotted and they could get killed. The rooftop was not really in use by that time because they got other militia that could just spot them in other rooftops and kill them, so they didn't use that much.
During Pablo's research, he found personal accounts written by some of the inhabitants. Here's one from the point of view of a young boy at the time.
We went to bed very early because the lights couldn't be left on past a certain time for fear of bombings. Because everything became so dark and so quiet, and at the same time there were so many people crowded together, it was a contrast that made me feel a strange sensation of loneliness and being lost.
And the fact that you were saying they were not able to go out is one of the things that I thought at the beginning. But there were people that needed to go out for many different reasons. And they exposed themselves and they got out of the embassy. And I don't know of any cases where they were not getting back. But I know mostly women went out to try to find food. The food was scarce. Everything was just like you couldn't find anything in Madrid back in those days. And then you were having 1,000 people in two buildings, right? So it was really hard.
Here's another account from a young boy, this time on the subject of food.
Regarding food, I remember how the embassy provided cans of cold meat and beautiful oranges distributed at a rate of one for every three or four people. The peels were eaten fried as a substitute for potatoes.
And it's really interesting because how they were organized inside of the house, right? So you have to think about 1,000 people in the house. But I calculated that more than 60, 65 people were living on each. People were sleeping on every single square meter that they could find. Entire families, like families of 25 members, with kids, men, women, everything. Yeah, there were no distinction. There were distinction in terms of men were sleeping in this side of the house and women were kind of sleeping in the other side. How they were organized, so they were chiefs of each house, right? So, and then there were a main chief of the house. So every house chief were kind of reporting to this main guy. And this is how they were basically knowing what necessities they have per house.
Some of the personal accounts Pablo uncovered showed that the inhabitants' organization included their own currency to be used within the embassy. They even minted their own rudimentary coins.
They were made from cardboard and their design, size and color denoted their value. The 25-cent piece, which I remembered most vividly, was rectangular and featured a Turkish flag. To ensure its authenticity, my mother marked the back of each coin with her initial M and her signature.
For Pablo's great-aunt, life inside the embassy went on like this for a while.
It was from the beginning of August, August 1936, until May 1937. So that was, good 9 months.
After 9 months, the embassy and its ambassador, Tefik Kamil Kapiler, reached their breaking point.
The Turkish ambassador, Kapiler, wanted to get a full evacuation. I want to get these people out from the Turkish embassy because I don't have any resources to maintain them in Madrid.
Negotiations began between the Turkish government and the Spanish Republicans, who were still defending Madrid and Barcelona.
At the beginning, at the really, really beginning of the conversations, and basically almost until the end, everyone should go to Istanbul. But the Spanish government on the Republican side changed, and then they got an agreement with the Turkish. So the agreement was to get everybody out of the embassy, but the military people should remain. Only women, children, and men that could not participate in the war would basically go to Italy. Men that could participate in the war, that means between 18 and 45, they should go to Istanbul.
The Republicans were not going to allow people who they saw as national sympathizers or potential combatants out of the city so they could go and join the nationalists. They wanted them out of the country. Istanbul, on the other side of the Mediterranean Ocean, was far enough away, but negotiators for the refugees argued it was too far away for people that posed no threat to the Republicans. Italy was favourable because they had friendlier ties to the nationalists, and they agreed to take them in. So a compromise was met. Women, children and older people could go to Italy, but any man of fighting age had to go all the way to Istanbul, and any active soldiers were not allowed to leave the embassy at all. They would stay behind, and the ambassador would have to deal with them later. But for Pablo's great aunt, she would be leaving Spain for the first time in her life.
The Turkish government sent a boat from Turkey to Valencia. And that boat stayed there until all the refugees from Madrid get to the boat. Madrid is 350 kilometers away from Valencia. So the logistics were amazing. All the embassies that did any kind of evacuations were through Palencia or Alicante in the coast. Basically, what they did was to hire buses, right? And they were doing trips with these people.
Here's another personal account from one of the women evacuated.
On the 13th of May 1937, the day designated for departure, after preparing ourselves both spiritually and physically, at 9 in the evening, we were called by our numbers to take our respective places in the bus. There were 10 vehicles, each bearing the flag of Turkey, and we were assigned to the second one. We had to leave the embassy with our number pinned to the label of our coat, another on the suitcase, and any other packages we were carrying, departing in an orderly manner.
The plan was for the boat to cross the Mediterranean, make a stop at the port of Syracuse on the east coast of Sicily to let off women and children, then carry on to the final destination of Istanbul with the remaining men. But as the boat approached the Sicilian shore, all the young men of fighting age saw their opportunity to cut their trip short.
When the boat was approaching Syracuse and they start to, not to get a fight with Turkish officials that were in the boat, but they were kind of like pressing, and at the end they jumped to the boat. They get off the boat. They were free. ...712 people went out from the embassy, and only 8 people got to Istanbul. And those 8 people were Turkish citizens.
When reports got back to the Spanish Republicans that only 8 people made it to Istanbul, Turkey and the Turkish ambassador in Madrid were in trouble.
That was a major point in the relationship of the Spanish Republicans and the Turkish, because that was not the agreement.
So what happened to Pablo's great aunt and everyone else who got off the boat in Sicily?
Some people were in camps until Franco's government prepared all the evacuation from Italy to take them to Spain. And some other people that got a little bit more resources, instead of waiting on the camp, they went up to Rome. My great auntie, among this group of 35 people, they got in Rome, and they were evacuated in a different way. But they ended up in the Spanish nationalist side.
After losing her husband, spending 9 months locked inside an embassy, surrounded by snipers, after traveling to Valencia, sailing across the Mediterranean, after landing in Sicily, then heading for Rome, after finally making it back to her home in Salamanca, you might think she would have told her family and friends about the ordeal. But she didn't say a word.
This woman survived the war. She lived like 75 years. And she didn't tell anyone about this.
But our story doesn't end with Pablo's great aunt. Back at the Turkish embassy in Madrid, there were still 58 people left behind.
When everybody got out, the agreement that was signed was that only those military people would stay there. But another covenant was that the Turkish ambassador couldn't get more people in. That was specifically clear on that agreement. But the Turkish ambassador let in more people.
The Turkish ambassador continued to take more people in, but now he was breaking the agreement he made with the Spanish government. Why did he do this? Pablo has a theory, which we'll get to a little later. But first, we have to mention one more twist involving the embassy. Unbeknownst to Ambassador Kapowler, a pair of nationalist spies gained access to 21 Zubrano Street.
By November 1937, everything got really messy because the two major spies of the 5th Column, they got into the Turkish embassy with fake names and fake identities.
The 5th Column was a secretive subversive group that worked against the Republican leadership from inside Madrid. This term was coined by Nationalist General Emilio Mola in a radio broadcast on October 16, 1936, in which he said he had a 5th column of sympathizers for General Franco among the Republicans holding the city of Madrid, and it would join his 4 columns of troops that were currently marching on the city. The term was popularized by writer Ernest Hemingway.
This is Ernest Hemingway. 4 columns advancing on Madrid shot their prisoner. When members of the 5th column were captured inside the city, they were also shot.
It only took 1 month to the intelligence of the Republicans to find out where they were. So the Republican intelligence and the government were kind of in this situation. How do we get these two high profiles of the 5th column that are doing all kind of sabotage? We need these guys. So what we are going to do is that we are going to assault the embassy. They got an excuse, a made-up excuse, where somebody inside of the embassy were just shooting some policemen that were on the street, which was not true.
The Republicans launched their assault on 21 Zurbano. They wanted to catch the spies and shut down the embassy for good. As they burst into the building,
At that same moment is that a wedding was being celebrated inside the embassy. So what happened is all the people got arrested. They separate the military people from the regular people.
The embassy was no more.
All people went from Madrid to Barcelona. And in Barcelona, they were in different prisons where they were doing all kind of works related to setting up a railroad. More than 15 people died because the conditions were really, really bad. They didn't have food, they were working more than 12 hours, and it was kind of all those crazy things. Actually, in those conditions, one of those high profiles of spy organizations that get into the embassy actually died, and the other one escaped. When Franco basically took Barcelona, the Republican army that were controlling these prisons, they get them into a train to France. And the second spy that survived escaped by jumping off the train.
So what about Ambassador Kapowler? What happened to him? And why did he ignore the agreement and continue taking people in?
More people got into this, and this is something that I'm still studying, why the ambassador basically broke that agreement. This is also related with the situation of Turkey with Italy.
Pablo thinks the answer involves a bit of statecraft and geopolitics.
We have to have in consideration that Turkey was a republic that was basically formed after the Ottoman Empire breakdown, right? So they were really young, and basically they were vulnerable in that sense. Franco was an ally of Italy and Germany, and also Italy got some interest in the Turkish territory, right? But also they got basically in a sandwich, because they got they got Russia on the other side wanting to supply the Republicans, the Spanish Republicans, right? And that's why I guess they try to play both sides, like to not be caught in the middle.
Turkey was attempting to walk a very thin line.
So I'm not looking at the Russians, so they can ship whatever they want through the Bosphorus. And I'm not looking into what's happening in Madrid in my embassy, because there is Italy allied with Franco, and I don't want to mess up, you know, anything. That's my hypothesis on why, I mean, you as an ambassador, you are ruled by your government, and you would not risk your reputation as ambassador to let people in without the permission of your government.
Pablo's theory is that the ambassador was given the okay from the Turkish government. He was still acting under their orders.
That permission would come from the higher. Because after that, Koperler, he was not a welcome man. After the embassy got assaulted, he left Spain after that. And also Turkey, as I said, they brought a relationship with the Republican, the Spanish Republican. But after that, he was in Serbia as a diplomat. He continued his diplomat career. That means that he didn't break any rules.
It's a fair point. If your ambassador did go against orders, why would you give him another diplomatic posting? Pablo's theory gains even more weight by the fact that the Turkish government sacked another diplomat at the same embassy.
The secretary of the embassy, he was dealing to get people in. So they were people who got into the embassy because the secretary of the embassy asked for money. And that guy was removed from the diplomacy career. I couldn't find anything about him. And all the people that I asked in Turkey, they couldn't find what happened with that guy. He just vanished.
2.5 years of siege have ended. Madrid, the heroic capital of the Spain of yesterday, has surrendered to the forces of General Franco.
If you know your history, you'll be aware of how the Civil War ended. On March 29th, 1939, Madrid surrendered to Franco's forces. The siege was over. The Nationalists had won.
For General Franco, this is the hour of triumph, and he rides appropriately with an escort of Moors.
In Madrid, Generalissimo Franco went to lay a sword of victory in the Church of Santa Barbara. It was the first of many triumphal occasions in which Franco and Spain celebrated the Nationalist victory.
When Franco took Madrid, all the refugees that were persecuted by the former Republicans, they were free. I wouldn't say all of them were Franco's supporters. Some people got into an embassy not because they were supporting Franco or they were supporting the coup, but because they were persecuted, basically. We tend to link, you know, that they were supporting Franco.
What happened to the civilians who supported the Republicans? Did roles reverse? They were the refugees now. Did they go knocking on the door of embassies?
That Franco took control of the city, they starting to ask asylum to the same embassies. Franco didn't allow the embassies to get the refugees. So at the end, no one from the former Republicans could have access to those embassies. They couldn't do the opposite.
What would Spain be like under Franco?
With all resistance quashed, Franco was free to rule Spain. His regime was characterized by authoritarianism and repression. During his rule, Franco's government committed numerous atrocities, including political persecution, censorship, and human rights abuses. He executed and imprisoned political opponents. He suppressed regional cultures and languages, particularly in regions like Catalonia and the Basque Country. His regime resulted in widespread suffering and the loss of life of many Spaniards. For Spain's current generation, it's been almost 50 years since the death of Franco and the end of his rule, and it's been over 80 years since the end of the Civil War. But this time period is still a delicate subject for Spanish people.
Yeah, there is some kind of resistance. Some people, they don't want to share that their family was on that embassy or any other embassy, because they could get pointed as Franco supporters. Yeah, that's a pity, because it shouldn't happen that way. This is what happens, right? And I shouldn't be worried about. But in Spain, even though I'm not aligned with the right, if I say what the left did wrong, then the left is going to eat me alive. But if I say something wrong, something that the right didn't do well, I'm going to be eaten by the rights.
Whatever flack Pablo gets, it doesn't seem to deter his passion for the project.
I'm still open to collect more testimonies. But I want this to be shared like a cross.
If you want to follow Pablo's research, or if you want to check out his embassy refugee lists for relatives, or if you want to submit any testimonies, you can go to Pablo's website he set up for the project at www.zurbano21.com. That's Zurbano and the number 21.com. This has been a story for yarnpodcast.com. Produced by me, John Roach. Huge thanks to Pablo de Miguel for talking to me. And thanks to Pablo's son, Martin, and his wife, Sofia, who voiced the diary entries you heard.